Today we have a internationally known musician who is known for playing and being a master of the sarod. I guess I'm pronouncing that right. He'll correct me in a minute here. And the as I introduce him, and what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk a little bit about Indian music in India and how it relates to the temple and the worships as he remembers it and is aware of it in India. And then Indian music as it went international and has been a phenomenon in the world, definitely since the 60s, and one of the great people that made Indian music famous and for this last couple of generations was Ravi Shankar, who he played with as a child. So we're having a continuation of different aspects. So without further ado, let me Krishnamurti Sridhar. Well, you know, it's really a delight to have you here, Sridhar. Yes.
I'm testing the air, and the air is testing me.
This is, yes, you know, one of my favorite stories about music from India is yep. This, and I'm sure you've heard it 1,000 times, is the one about when Hazrat Anayat Khan came to America in about 1900, 1910,
yep.
Traveled around mostly at circuses and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And from there, you know, he got his orchestra went out and they, you know, they tuned up, you know, because, you know, it got all those strings. I mean, when I heard the sarod had 25 strings, and yep. I thought, I guess the first thing you learned was patience, you know.
Yep.
You get all those strings and attunement, that must be, I mean, I found it hard just to try to get a 6-string guitar in tune, you know. I mean, 25 strings. Well, whatever. So they would go out and they would be tuning up their instruments and so forth, and people would be sitting listening to them respectfully. And after they were just about ready to get started, everybody would start applauding because they figured the performance was over.
That's true.
And believe it or not, I'm quite sure that you may run into that even to today.
Yep. Very common.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. So, let's talk a little bit about, you know, Indian music in India, specifically Indian music as it's related to temples. And I was thinking specifically of the Dravidian temples in South India, but you both are conversant with the South Indian style of music, which is called what, Karnak?
Yes, Carnatic.
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 Now, where does that word come from? What does it mean?
Karnataka is a region where the music developed.
Uh-huh.
And there's a state called Karnataka in India now. Today,
there is?
And the whole Karnataka region, that's where the music developed in the temples.
Uh-huh.
8,000 years ago, the essence of Carnatic classical music developed in the temples through temple music, which came from the Samaveda, which has 4 notes.
Right.
And from those 4 notes of Samavedic chanting came the 5 elemental ragas, earth, water, fire, and so forth. And from that came most of the mantras were chanted in Samavedic tune, which was based around 4 notes. And it's very similar to 7th, 8th century Gregorian music.
Yeah.
Centered around 3 or 4 notes only.
Right.
It's very spiritual. And from those notes came several other notes and came an octave. From the octave came the scales. From the scales came the ragas.
Yeah. Now ragas, are they like, apparently a raga, as I was thinking of it, I may be completely wrong, is like a pattern of composition. But it's sort of like, these are what the notes, these are the, this is the pattern, and you play to this pattern. But the way you get, the way you put the pattern together can be different. Is that right?
Yep. Raga is more like a language, A to Z.
Uh-huh.
You can speak English in 10 minutes or 10 hours all your lifetime, depending what subject you choose and to what feeling you put into that subject.
Right.
So it's more like when you see the alphabets in French, it's called French raga.
Right.
You see them in Scandinavian, German, the same letters, but
right.
takes a different shape and different culture.
Well, that would be then a different, would that be a different raga, different words?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
with different words. And also ragas, there are ragas which have no words. They don't have to have words.
Yeah.
It's mostly feeling. Traditionally, the yogis use raga to produce sound from their breath. They would say normally you cannot speak when you inhale. You have to speak when you exhale.
Right.
So when you exhale, you produce the sound, the note, mm-hmm. the mantra, the language, a feeling, melody.
And the thing in many traditional cultures is that for instance, the mathematics of the architecture that goes into the construction of the temple is related to the same mathematics that's true to the music.
Yeah, because every temple traditionally has been built on 7 psychic centers. So they start building those 7 psychic centers at the bottom, underneath the ground. And then on each layer, on each psychic center, there are special notes which are chanted in the Samaveda. They used to chant their notes with the mantras. And then when they come to the top chakra, that's where they lay the foundation of the sanctum sanctorum for the main temple. So when that is set, which is the psychic centers are set from the bottom, then they build the body around it. The body depends on the architecture and the design, but the 7 psychic centers are traditional Vedically. It has to be followed in that way.
So okay, now let's make this a little mundane for me at least. So let's say I'm a tourist and sort of middle caste Hindu. What are temples mean for me in my local village, in my local city where I'm living? There's a couple of temples, and so what do they mean? Why would I go there? Do I go there just to pray to God, or do I go there to get instruction? What would I do with a temple?
Depends. If you're religious, then you go there to make business with God.
Mm-hmm.
You ask him for some boon and you say, if I pass my examination or if I get a good job, I will donate some money to the temple. Most people seem to be religious, doing business with God rather than spiritual. They uh-huh. stick to the rituals, thinking that the ritual is God.
Right. In other words, God, I know what I need better than you do, so I'll tell you what it is that I want, and you give it to me, and then I'll be happy.
Exactly.
And if you don't give it to me, well, I won't give you anything in return.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So some of us get smarter than that, or more sly,
yeah. Yeah,
and say, "Hey, God, I don't know what's best for me, but I know you do. Give it, sock it to me and see what happens."
True.
And unfortunately, you never can tell what's going to happen.
I think it's better to have the temple in your heart.
Uh-huh.
And worship the divinity in the heart.
Right.
Like that you don't have to depend on external sources, like going to a temple every day. If you don't go one day, if you missed a day, you'll feel bad you didn't go. It's like missing a health club one day and then you feel uncomfortable. So if you have the temple in your heart, if you're aware of it and live in the present, not to worry about the past or the future, of course you have to plan for the future, but still if you don't worry about it, live in the present, the true being, then probably you don't need to go to the temple, because temple is inside you, you're at peace. It's the peace that matters, not happiness or pieces of happiness.
Okay, so one of the ways that we might experience peace, or at least not be bored in our peace, is music.
Yeah.
So how does music fit into temple life and in India in a general way?
Generally, great pujaris, the priests and musicians, composed songs on their favorite chosen family deities. And composers used to sit and compose. If it was a saint, he would just go into a sanctorum, start singing, and the songs would come in. Spontaneous composition, and some of his followers would write it on a palm leaf so that it is preserved for posterity. So they would go on singing the songs, composing songs. So in Carnatic, there was a great trinity called Tyagaraja, Shama Shastri, and Muthuswami Dikshadhar. Tyagaraja was a very great saint. Mm-hmm. He composed more than about 80,000 songs. He was a saint. He didn't have to sit to compose.
It just poured out
through devotion.
Yeah.
Devotion is a deep ocean. If you swim in the deep ocean of devotion, words will come automatically. You don't have to create a knowledge to compose.
In the West, probably, if people know about him, but Jalaluddin Rumi, who was the great Sufi poet.
Yes, I've heard of him.
He's very similar in the same way in terms that...
That's true.
He didn't write poetry down. He just spoke it.
That's true.
And we're reciting fragments of his writings to this day that we've translated into English.
Yeah.
You know, but his own poetic abilities, he was just a wash in the love of the divine or whatever.
Yeah, in those days, great seekers never wrote books. Today, people write books to seek something. See?
This is a slight swipe at the people say, people know that I've read a lot, so they figure, oh, you should write a book. I said, I've read a lot. I know that there's really not a necessity for another book. There are too many of them already. But you can't say that about music. Now let's take a raga. Now that, maybe there's one or two ragas that you particularly like and you return to play differently each time.
Yeah.
And apparently each time you play it, it's a different tune in a way.
Yeah, it's like cooking. You cook the same curry, use the same recipe, same ingredients, but the way you cook it, each time the proportion of the spices is different.
Yeah.
It comes through feeling, so the taste is different.
Yeah, so it tastes a little different.
So it's
different.
The same like raga. So each time you repeat the same, the feeling is different.
Of course. In the Western music, when Bach wrote down his music, it was to be pretty much played the way it looked. But that's not the same with Indian music, right?
No, it's not the same because you have to follow the feeling with which the music was written, not the notes.
Yeah.
See, Bach's music is more touching if it was heard during his period.
Right.
Then if you listen to his composition played by a modern young generation musician, the feeling will not be the same. Same with ragas. If you listen to ragas that you heard 40 years ago and the same played by modern musicians, we are in a different environment, different surrounding. So the feeling is different.
Okay, now we come to the music as it was played in the temples, part of the music will be played in the temples just from the spontaneous devotion of the saints.
Yep.
Part of it would be played because somebody in the family wanted to honor someone or something like that. So it was part of like a gift to the temple.
Yeah.
And the musicians are supported that way. Now we come to the West, and in the West we've created a big divide between. In Africa, everybody's musical. Everybody plays music
True.
In Africa,
True.
Right? But I don't know if that's true in India, but in the West, we're all taught that only the professionals sing, and the amateurs are not necessarily given much respect.
Yeah, there has been a class consciousness for music. In Europe, they would say, only the elite class were allowed to go to classical concerts. Similarly, in India. Classical music, temple music was restricted to Brahmins only. Religious music, temple music, anything outside the temple music was meant for low class. For example, in many temples there were this Nadaswaram players, which is the loudest instrument in the world.
Uh-huh.
It's like an oboe but 100 times louder.
Okay.
And that would be always played by low caste musicians who were not allowed inside the temple except when they were called to wake in the gods to start the puja by the priest, and then in the evening you would put the god to sleep and go. For that kind of music, it was not, Brahmins were not allowed to do. And so also similarly dance, classical dance forms were not allowed by Brahmin communities. It was only for non-Brahmins.
So you had about singing or the recitation of the Vedas were obviously just reserved for the Brahmin, right?
Yeah, because Brahmin class was mainly responsible for having spiritual knowledge.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a Brahmin to read that. If you have the knowledge and follow the path, you're already a Brahmin.
Yeah.
But then it got discriminated in the end.
Yeah. So now we're going to the West. Now, when you were a boy, you actually were in Ravi Shankar's orchestra or whatever it would be called.
Yeah.
Had an opportunity to play with him in a variety of ways, which must have been incredibly exciting.
Yes, it was.
I mean, I remember how exciting I found his albums are when I was a young guy and listening to him. And so as you've seen it all over the years, how would you say the difference is between, you know, music, particularly Indian music that you represent, to in the West, particularly in the terms of the way we do it in concerts and, you know, outside of the temple, as it were?
Normally, when you play outside of the temples, you have to, as we say, cut the body according to the coat. You can't go as deeply into music as you would do in a temple concert or in a concert in India. So you have to condense the whole thing into short, because in India we would play raga for about 2 hours or 3 hours, but we can't do that in the West because people will feel bored. Most concerts in India lasted 6-7 hours, whereas in the West it's not more than 1.5 hours. So to cut it to that size, you lose a lot while playing. So we have to play with the notes mostly than play with the feeling. So it takes time. The audience has to be well educated before they are prepared to listen to hours of Indian music concert. And unfortunately, times have changed now. The music is changing. Indian music is not that in demand as it used to be in the 60s. The whole concept has changed, and they have gone into fusion music mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more like trying to mix oil and water, in my opinion.
And by fusion music, you mean like rock and roll modes with a sitar added or something like
that? Yeah, not only that. Instrumental fusion is fine, but using ragas with other music, it's more like playing with the notes. Like somebody speaking English in a village, you know, using the words but not knowing the meaning or the feeling behind.
Yeah.
So.
Well, one of the and when you were saying nodes here, you're referring to at least partly to what are usually called chakras, I guess.
Yeah, every chakra is related to a posture. Every posture is related to a particular pranayama or breathing technique, and every breath is connected to a mantra, and every mantra is connected to a goddess.
Yeah.
So in the temple music in those days, the temples were so hugely built, there were room to teach yoga, conduct Vedic schools and music therapy sessions, and they would teach you, if you learned mantra, they will teach you what the note should be when you chant and what the posture should be you should sitting in to chant the mantras and what kind of breathing you should be doing.
Now in the West, we've taken over in a gross sense the idea of the chakras.
Yeah.
But at least as I'm aware, that a lot of the people out there, if you look at the books, you see they're just making it up.
Yes.
They're just imagining this is what it means, and they're going by their own they think their own experience, but so their own, more of their imagination than understanding it in any kind of depth.
Also, they live on other people's experiences.
Yeah,
they read books written by someone else who has commented on a great seeker, and then they take it on themselves, you see.
And then they imagine the connections, and I think that those are the connections that are imagined.
You see, traditionally they would say that unless you have aim, principle, and discipline, you cannot learn any kind of spiritual practice. And if you cannot control your senses, the desires would control them. If you cannot control your desires, the actions would control them. If you cannot control your actions, the addiction would control them. If you can't control your addiction, the fate will take control of the addiction.
Life's rough.
It has to be rough. Nothing is a smooth flow anyway.
Yeah. So, right. Well, the river flows down no matter what rocks it rolls around.
Yeah. Sometimes it rolls the rocks. Sometimes the rocks block the river.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's how it is. So there's so much of temptation to do shopping and packaging and reselling. So there's no time to experience something. That's why I would always advise them to put a filter in between the brain and the mouth.
Well, unfortunately, this show would be very quiet if I actually did that. As I said, this is the only show which the object is spirituality in its highest form, which is complete silence. And yeah, I'm the chittering bird that's marking out that silence.
No, the problem begins when spiritual knowledge is put into a cage and called religion with dogmas. When it's institutionalized, the spirit is not there.
Yeah.
You don't find any spirit in any of these holy places, temples or churches or mosques or anywhere nowadays.
I think he was an Indian, a Swami Kumaraswamy.
Uh-huh.
who lived. He was at the Boston Museum of Art in the at the turn of the last century, about 1900, 1920. And he was one of the founders of what's now known as traditionalism. Oh. Well, one of the things he said in his writings, which are quite profound, actually, and they were oriented to traditional things. Like one of the last things he wrote was a study of traditional Indian psychology.
Wow.
You know, but he said that the reason I'm interested in dogmas is not because they're dogmas, but rather, what do they mean that somebody thought they should be a dogma? You know? So he had this conservative approach that dogmas got to be dogmas, not necessarily because somebody thought that they were crucial to a certain understanding of some profound truth. So instead of just saying, oh, I don't like that, it's just a dogma, we should say, well, okay, it's a dogma. I don't understand what it means. Let's see if I can find out why it got that way, and then I can throw it away or I can modify it. But unless I find out what it means, that's the conservative aspect of religion. You know, so then so you can find that, you know, there may be encrusted deep into the inside that old crusty form of the dogma, there may be some profound truth. Or there may not be. There may be
maybe
a profound misunderstanding
of this. Truth is covered by dogma, probably.
Yes.
On purpose.
Oh, well, yes. And
it could be.
Perhaps on purpose, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Perhaps on purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's sort of like, you know, there is a thing where you there are certain things you can't understand. If you're a little child, you can't. It's very hard for you to understand adult sexuality. I mean, in fact,
true.
It's if you're asked to understand it or experience it, it's a form of abuse and can harm you.
Yeah.
So you know, so there are developmental things, and in the same way that I remember one Swami once said the same way with Kundalini. You know?
Yeah.
If Kundalini rises, that's good, but you don't necessarily force the Kundalini to rise. At least that's what he was suggesting.
No, but there's a wrong notion about Kundalini. They don't realize it happens only to one in a billion seekers.
Yes, yes.
Not to anybody.
And it's very unusual.
Yeah, somebody once came to me in France and said, oh, give me a mantra and I want to work on it to raise my Kundalini. I said, you do what you have been doing. And I put him in a special bedroom to sleep and said, do this mantra about an hour or so. In the morning he woke up and said, thank you so much. My Kundalini went so high I didn't know what to do, and it was difficult to bring it down. I said, you fool, it was not the Kundalini. Before I put you in bed, I switched on the electric blanket.
So all those flashes of sweating that he was doing in the middle of the night was
But
not
despite all that, he still wanted to stick to his experience. He didn't want to reject the fact that I switched on the electric blanket, but that's how it goes. They want quick fixes, you see.
Did you ever have the opportunity to meet Gopi Krishna, who was one of the people who wrote about his experience of Kundalini?
No. I heard of him, but I never met him.
You never met him? Yeah, well, he wrote a book which has come out in a sort of unabridged form now, which was doing a regular meditation in which he meditated visualizing the lotus in the top of his head, you know. And, you know, and then one day he noticed these little trickles of feeling and stirring, you know, and he didn't pay too much attention to it. And then it sort of shot up him, and he had a very hard time. He traveled all through India, going to various masters and talking to various people to try to get people to help him understand what had happened to him. Because obviously when his Kundalini arose, it didn't arise, you know, in a unencumbered fashion, it created some difficulty for him.
See, any kind of practice, if you do with expectation, it's a mistake.
Yeah.
Especially in the spiritual path. I'm going to do meditation to raise my Kundalini.
Right.
It will not happen. You just live in the experience of the process of meditation.
Right.
See, now rather than looking for the target and waiting, expecting some great experience there, no matter on what target you meditate, if you do it properly, the process itself will bring you big relief and elevates you to a higher status.
Yeah.
You don't need to decipher on what you did, what happened. You should never sort of go delve into it to find out what happened during the meditation. Then you start discussing. Then it's intellectualized. Then it's put into a book. Then it gives a separate title. This is that school of meditation. then it's there out in the market for sale.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's definitely, in some ways, that's definitely what happened to Gopi Krishna. He did come here and live for the last, I guess, almost 20 years of his life. He was in the West and in New York. But
see, in those days, they would say most of the swamis, so-called, who traveled, left India, dropouts from their spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
They left with little bit of mantric power or whatever power they had.
Yeah.
And they spent it to buy the West. That's all, to build ashrams for themselves. Should not spend your spiritual energy that you have earned, you know, you should conserve it, they say. Then you, like a magnet, you attract iron. Otherwise, magnet goes to the iron.
Yeah.
So that's right. What happened with the gurus here.
They're all stuck in the various...
For them, the rich disciples were the magnets, and they became the iron. They got attracted to them.
Yes, I always...
And then it ended up with abuse in all the forms. So with the abuse, what happened? Then the true devotees lose their devotion for the subject and the teacher and the culture.
Yeah.
So it is a problem.
I've become more sympathetic, or maybe more forgiving, of some of these teachers who've come to the West, because we as Westerners put incredible projections on them with no sense of limitation, no sense that these people are not infallible.
Yeah.
They're not no matter how relatively pure or stable they were in the context of their own lives and their own understanding, when they're put into the context of an American thing where anything goes, and you can find out that if you say it, people will believe it in ways that you could never imagine possible.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you find that you have access to a power that would never have happened in a traditional context, because people would know that there are limitations you just don't cross. And you can find that wasn't the case in America. You could cross all those limitations.
See, also traditionally in those days, great masters, all of them were genuine. There were no fakes. So everybody blindly trusted and followed them with deep faith and devotion.
Yeah.
And if you went to a master, before he accepts you, he would read your mind psychically, and he would find out the level of depth of devotion you have for the subject, for learning, and towards the teacher. Then he will shape your path.
Yeah.
Nowadays, they have to impress the public for them to be accepted as a master. You see, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So that's why in India, those swamis who travel in the West, Indians don't have much regard for them.
Okay, well, we're about halfway through in terms of the time we have today to talk about it. And what we've talked about is generally spirituality and generally aspects of the music. Now, that would be kind of fun to deal with in the next part. And you are listening to Touchstones. I'm Paul Nagy, and we're speaking to Sridhar, who is an Indian classical musician. You practice or mention a kind of yoga, which you call Nadi yoga.
Yeah, Nadi, yoga of sound.
And so you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Traditionally, when you start an instrument, you have to learn vocal first. And when you learn vocal, you have to learn the posture first. Sit in a particular posture, then they will teach you how to breathe in that posture for a month or two before they start the first notes in music.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will teach you how to breathe gently, how to hold in, how to hold out. And then they will say how to advise you how from which chakra or psychic center of the body you should try to breathe. And they'll give you different postures for different chakras. And after 6 months, they'll give you the first notes in music, which they will have expected you to sing for at least 3 hours nonstop. And then they teach you...
That's daily.
Daily.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yes. And then they will also tell you how notes are related to colors.
Right.
Microtones with micro colors.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will tell you what are the feeling behind the colors and the notes. So, and then if anybody has a problem with him or herself, then the master will tell you, sing this particular note in this posture with this breathing for an hour.
Okay,
and then it will have an effect of sound. And also, Nadi Yoga also means any form of spiritual practice has four paths. One is entertainment, the other is therapy, third is business, and the fourth is higher state of attainment.
Yeah, and my bias on this show is besides entertainment, which is for you out there, but is usually the highest. I try to orient it to this highest spiritual thing, but I get distracted like everybody else. I suddenly put on my anthropology hat and I say, now is this knowledge if I went to you and studied this stuff of Nada Yoga, and you showed me how this chakra was related to this color and this sound, and I learned the pranayama that goes with it. That's the breathing techniques that go with it.
True.
And I practice it, and I practice the proper asanas that are related to it. Now, if I went to someone else who was trained in a similar tradition, would they be giving me the same stuff, or would they be doing something different? In other words, how much of it is, objective, and how much of it is subjective?
Well, it's out of vogue now. When I studied in the Himalayas with my master, I was the last in the 100 students.
Uh-huh.
And after that, I don't know, they left and most of them got settled in family life. So now it is more popular as a subject rather than a discipline of learning.
So in other words, it's less objective now than it was in the past.
Yeah, the discipline. People are more nowadays longing to bring out the knowledge to sell it, to impress people, like old wine in new bottles. It's the same old message coming through different labels and different shapes of bottles. So I teach only those who have the discipline to learn. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. Because I feel in the West that people want to learn only to package it and start their own school. Like they go to a yoga class for 10 days and get a certificate to teach. Or any other form of Tai Chi or Qigong.
Yeah,
you know, they
do.
It's not a healthy sign. You need discipline to learn and devotion.
Yeah.
And they are more intellectual than devotional.
Yeah,
that's
the
problem.
Like for instance, one of the people that we talked about briefly a few weeks ago was who's on the circuit now, is very well known. You know, has talked to Oprah. what's his name? Eckhart Tolle.
Uh huh.
Now, have you ever heard or seen anything that Eckhart Tolle did? No.
What does he do?
Well, he was somebody that wrote a book called The Power of Now, and he basically just emphasizes that, you know, in order to be in touch with anything, you have to be in the now.
In the now, yes.
Right, which is, I learned that the first day of my meditation class.
Yeah, so, that's good.
You know, I mean, that was when I was taught traditional meditation way back when, you know, they said, you know, the only place that you can meditate is now. And so now is, you know, there's no future, there's no past, there's only now.
Yep.
And,
live in the now.
This is fundamental meditation 101.
Yep.
Now, what he did is he stuck with that one idea, and he developed it over a period of time and understood how it all related to his ultimate consciousness and so well-being and so forth. And he came up with his own little, you know, statements about these things. Which, you know, for the long run are basically relatively genuine. In other words, they genuinely reflect his experience, and his experience is kind of what anybody would experience, you know, just paying attention to now and not getting caught up in our thoughts and memories and feelings and various ways that we distract ourselves. So Eckhart Tolle has done this, and he's become, you know, now, if he, you know, he got marketed a few years ago, and now he's become sort of a new age guru. But one of the things that's nice about him that isn't necessarily true, at least by my lights, which is obviously biased as all get out, but is that he spent 20 plus years working with this before he ever wrote a book, before he ever started teaching anybody. In fact, he doesn't consider himself a teacher. You know, other people consider him a teacher. You know, and, you know, he finds it kind of funny that he's out there talking about people about the now, and they're making such a big deal out of it. But here it was, a very fundamental, absolutely foundational understanding of meditation, that it only takes place in the now. And taking that one idea, he's become a phenomenal success in America. You know, and it wasn't like the now didn't exist before Eckhart Tolle came around to tell us about it. And nor was this idea not known. It was just nobody wasn't paying attention. They weren't paying attention. They said, oh, the now, okay, and then what's the next thing? What's the next thing? And they forget, you know, just how profound some of those things are. I guess the same way with music.
Yeah, they always want, okay, where do we go from here now? Mm-hmm. What will the effect of this raga be? What will the effect of this lesson be? they always try to investigate, ask you more questions before they start the disciplinary practice.
Yeah.
In India, we don't question the master. We just follow them. And after a month or so, the master will ask, where did you go? Where did it take you? Then he will analyze. Whereas nowadays, before you give the lesson, they want to know what will the effect be, what will happen.
But unfortunately,
it's more intellectualizing it.
If the master told me what the effect would be, I would accommodate your expectation. Oh yeah, it does sound. It does feel like that. Oh yeah, you know.
No, but if he gave that expectation, then you will start expecting what he said.
Yeah.
That's why they wouldn't tell you. But after a month, they would write their experience, the effect of it on a piece of paper, and they would ask you to write on the same. Then they will exchange notes, and it will be the same.
Yeah, which is a little more empirical. A little more empirical.
It's better that you discover yourself the effect rather than being told to expect.
Right, right.
So it doesn't work.
And so it's sort of like, it's really hard to rush baking a cake.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's true you can turn up the oven, but it doesn't. What it means is you're going to have, a hard crust and a soggy inside.
That's true. It takes its own time to build up. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got so things take time to cook, and obviously patience is not one of the modes of being in the now that we're particularly happy with.
Yeah. Yeah. In this fast world, there's no patience.
Yes. Yes.
No.
But the
there are more patients than patients.
Yeah. Yeah, and unfortunately, people think that become a patient means that you have to be in a hospital, right?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Or you have to be tamasic.
Yeah,
and lazy to be patient.
Oh yeah,
sluggish.
Oh, that's why I like my tamasic ways. Yeah. Yeah, the corpse is not necessarily the best asana for all modes of life, right?
True. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's continue about. Okay, let me zero in on you personally.
Mm-hmm.
So, what's your day like? I mean, you practice this traditional mode. So, you actually spend a good deal of your day practicing yoga. Of some sort.
But at least 2 hours minimum, I do.
Okay, what do you do when you're doing your yoga?
Do my postures. Start with calming the body, then calming the mind, and then I start the exercises. Then do some deep breathing exercises, holding in, holding out.
Mm-hmm.
And I live in that. I keep floating in the effect of it. I don't expect to go far or anywhere. I am where it takes me, in that position.
Right. So let's say, you wake up. Ta-da, okay. You're waking up.
Okay.
Ta-da,
Yep.
Pay attention to your dreams or whatever that is about.
I don't pay attention to dreams.
No,
I don't dream. You spend all your life dreaming about the past and the future, the present.
I'm always dreaming I'm somebody else, but that's it's just to make my life more interesting. Let's see. So what do you do with the calming stuff for yourself? How do you calm your mind?
Have a shower and relax for a while, because mm-hmm. you can't do yoga unless the body is fully awake.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get up 4 in the morning, your mind is awake, but the body is still sleepy. It will not cooperate. So you have to wait until the body and the mind are ready. And then that's when the body is supple, the mind is supple.
So you'll relax, shower, maybe a little breakfast, or you wait for breakfast?
No, no breakfast. We don't eat before yoga asanas, only afterwards.
So,
you can have a drink, but no solid food, traditionally.
Right.
So relax, and after an hour or so, I start postures,
mm-hmm.
and then the body is fully awake.
Okay, yeah. So what kinds of postures do you do that you can explain?
Yeah, salutation to the sun, and then fish postures, then all the Indian names.
Is that the classic salutation to the
classic
sun,
one,
which is really open up and
Yeah, they say you should stay in a posture for as long as possible.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just looking there for a second. Let me get my my things. Yeah. I've seen books that have talked about the salutation to the sun.
Yeah.
Are those true?
It is true, but the way they practice is not probably true. Yoga is defined as sthira sukha asana, stable comfortable posture. Mm-hmm. You stay in one posture, you work hard to go to that posture, then you stay in that posture, and once you're able to stay there for 10-20 minutes, then you do different types of breathing from different psychic centers. And if you are practicing mantras, then you do different mantras with meditation on the particular deity of that mantra in that posture. So one posture should take at least 30 minutes.
One posture should take 30 minutes.
Because once you reach the pose, it's like driving a car to a shop.
Right.
Once you shop, you cannot say, I've reached the shop, I'll go back home. You get out of the car, go into the shop, do some shopping.
Well, I wanted my favorite pose of the corpse. I think I would be sound asleep after 30 minutes.
That's good. If you get sound sleep, that's good also. Yeah, there's nothing wrong in that.
That's right.
If it helps the body to sleep and calm down, why not?
Yeah, right. Right.
So
but let's take one of the things like the bow. I think is an interesting one.
Yeah,
we got somebody in here taking photographs of those people.
Photographing of our minds.
Yeah, or of our conversations. Yeah, But the let's say I'm doing something like if you did like the cobra, which is where. You rear up and you're lying prostrate flat with belly down.
Yep.
And then you move up without holding without using your hands or your arms.
Yes.
As much back flex as you can with your back.
Yep.
That would be a very bad description of what a cobra would be like.
Yep.
Can you really hold up for 30 minutes or?
I can. I'm used to it.
Yeah.
I mean, 45 years of yoga, I'm used to it.
Yeah. But most of us would,
Because there is a lot to be done. Yeah. A lot to be done when you're in that posture. It's not just going there and then coming down.
Right.
There is a lot of work to be done which holds you for 30 minutes and you won't feel the pain or stress anywhere.
Yeah. And well, if you're used to it, I could see that. But, what would be done, for instance, in a posture like that? What do you do? Is there like a greeting that you go through inside yourself about this is what this is? You go into a mode of consciousness?
Yeah, it is a mode of consciousness, and you try to breathe from every psychic center and try to meditate on every psychic center, or if somebody is practicing mantras.
And in that particular posture.
In that particular posture, and there's a lot of mantric chanting also goes. Mm-hmm. If he's a musician like me, I would just singing different tones on that posture to open up the vocal cord. In fact, when I lived in France, I used to give this cobra posture for opera singers. Mm-hmm. Students who are learning vocal were problem with their vocal cords, so I used to put them in this pose and give them notes to chant from, not necessarily Indian raga notes, also Western notes, to chant, and how much to breathe and how much to hold and how much to exhale and how much to hold with each note, and that helped in that posture to open up the vocal cord.
That's really fascinating. Okay, well, there are obviously hundreds of or thousands of asanas, which are the postures that one can take for this type of thing. So, of course, then the next question that arises is, how do you decide on your own daily practice how to vary it, or how which ones are like foundational for you and which ones are variant?
No, I've been doing the same postures given by my guru in the Himalayas for 45-50 years. Mm-hmm. I stick to them basically. But once I'm inside, I take my own route.
So
I improvise on my own based on what he gave me.
Yeah.
So the point is, you should stick to the original postures.
Right.
But once you're inside, you do as you want, like chanting any note you want from any psychic center.
So in some ways, you're almost saying it's the same way that you would do a raga, right?
Exactly. It is. It is exactly. You understood. That's right.
Yeah.
It is a raga. You have to improvise within the asanas. Once you improvise with pranayama and postures and chanting of notes, then that will take you to a higher level of consciousness. But if you meet with therapeutic effects, positive, then you get stuck to it, then you'll write a book, this posture brings this therapeutic effect, but you're not going beyond.
Yeah.
Or while you walk on the path, you'll come across lots of temptations like therapy, good health, psychic powers. If you surrender to them, you will not reach your goal.
Now, recently, a few years ago, an anthropologist named Felicia Goodman discovered by having people take the postures that were that she found in the petroglyphs in the caves, in the Neolithic caves. So she found that the few shaman, the few humans, pictures that were shown, they were in different postures.
Yep.
Lying down, sitting, kneeling, yep. That type of thing. So she had groups of people assume these relatively simple postures. And then she, through rattles and other ways, would enter an altered state of consciousness. And what would happen is groups of people who had nothing the same would have similar experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a certain posture, I don't remember exactly which is which now. People would all have a sense of descending into the underworld. Or they would have a sense of flight into the sky.
Sky, yeah.
Or they would have a sense of opening everything up, yep. An endless expanse. And each posture gave, though people experienced them quite differently. In other words, they dreamt them differently.
Mm.
In terms of the actual imagery they had. But what was the same was the context. In other words, this one, there was a sense of falling, going deep. And another one, there was a sense of rising up. And another one, there was a sense of infinite expanse or, you know, a sense of time, timelessness evolved. So, she found that this was amazing that people had these who, you know, otherwise had no yoga experiences, no meditation experiences. But there was a similarity of things. And, she wrote, obviously, eventually around, good anthropologist. She wrote a book about the subject. And she said, well, of course, the problem is since I'm telling you what people experienced, it sort of takes the empiricism away of it. You know, the idea of it is to ask people to do the postures without telling them what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
And then compare what they've had to say, after they've... or after they've actually done it.
Yeah.
But in some ways, what you sound like is it sounds like that's a very loose version of what you're doing, which is much more detailed, much more elaborated, and much more and definitely much more part of the structure of your life. I really have to apologize. One of the reasons that you're on this show is to tell people about your concert that's coming up this Saturday. So I apologize. We should have mentioned this a lot sooner than right now. But you're this Saturday at the Barn in Valhalla, where you're going to be doing a concert, right?
Yep.
So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
It is a kind of another yoga concert again, where I expect the audience to join me and... surrender for that moment and allow the sound to pass through the system.
So it's a meditative experience.
And it depends how they take it. If they take it as an entertainment, they wouldn't get experience
right.
on the deeper level.
Well, I expect to go and meditate with myself.
Yeah, that's fine. Even if you fall asleep, it's fine. It will lead you to an elevated state.
Sometimes my most elevated states are between my snores, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll produce the same note equivalent to your snore. It will help. The point is, for people to surrender to the sound. In the beginning, there is a musician, the audience, and the musical instrument. In the end, all three merge into the ocean of sound. And that's what I try to share with the audience. And I had good feedback so far in many years. So by listening from the heart, it moves you, moves your chakras. It moves the energy in the body. But by listening from the head, it only moves the brain.
So I highly recommend that people come and go to this concert. I'm going to be there, and what I'm planning on doing when I go there is just basically sit down, relax, do a little quiet breathing, and then just surrender to the sound.
Come with no expectation and leave with surprises.
Sounds good, and. And I've been listening to some of your CDs, of which of course I didn't bring one to share. But one of the things I did notice about your CDs was that you don't necessarily play to the rhythmic expectations of an audience. Let's jazz it up so I can sway and move and dance and wiggle. I might like to do that, but the way you're doing your sarod, which is you play it and it's definitely very meditative, and you let it things, and it really requires the listener to slow down and pay attention.
But also it makes people dance. When in Europe, whenever I played slow movements, I've seen women quietly dancing, men quietly dancing in a corner without making noise during the first movement.
Right.
They see it as the sound moving their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You see, whereas the breath moves my sound.
Right. They're allowing the sound to move their bodies, which will get them run to their breath.
So when
breath
there is
eventually.
Total surrender, then it takes you to a different state.
Yeah.
When the ego comes between the head and the heart, then it becomes difficult to feel or experience something on a deeper level.
Yeah. Yeah. So, So as far as your own spiritual life goes, you practice your yoga about 2 hours a day.
Minimum, yeah.
And then you're also a vegetarian, right?
Yeah, I've been a vegetarian. Yeah,
It's
common in India. About 80% of Indians have been vegetarians during my days. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a common practice. Yeah,
do you have students, Western students?
Yeah, quite a lot. Yeah. Yeah.
And so what would, if I wanted to be a student, and unfortunately I'm way too old and crusty to want to be a student, but if I wanted to be a student, what would I do? What would I do?
You should develop discipline first.
Well, that excludes me and probably 90% of the people that are going to want to.
Yeah.
Okay, so presume that I have some kind of discipline.
Okay.
Right, okay, you know, I managed to graduate college, you know.
Yeah, then I will teach you traditionally, as I learned it.
Which, and by traditionally, that means that the person would actually...
For example, when I started music, the master taught me how to sit in the posture with which I will play the instrument in the future. Sitting in the posture without instrument for 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
next 2 weeks sitting in the posture with the instrument and not playing, third 2 weeks sitting in the posture with the instrument and breathing,
mm-hmm.
deeply holding, and in the fourth 2 weeks he'll give you the first lessons, which he will expect you to play 2 to 3 hours continuously. So it's all the preparation. So if you came to me to learn, I know that you will want to rest or stretch your legs after some time. To avoid that, I'll first make you sit in a posture.
Right.
I will try to make the posture steady, stable, mm-hmm. and comfortable.
Right.
And then breathe gently and then meditate on yourself. And then give you the instrument when I am confident that you'll be able to play at least for an hour or half an hour nonstop.
Yeah, without your legs going to sleep and everything.
Exactly.
Else.
That is the teacher's problem.
Right.
The teacher's job is to give the exercises to the body so that it doesn't tire the student
right.
or give pain. That's our job.
Yeah, yeah.
So if there is a discipline, it becomes much easier. In those days, all students had discipline. I had to practice 18 hours a day of music and yoga all the time. So it was part of our daily life. And I've been 14 generations into temple music. So yoga was part of it. Mantra was part of it, whether we wanted to learn yoga or not. In those days, we never went to a master and said, I want to learn yoga or I want to learn mantra. If you said you want to learn music, mantra and yoga came.
Yeah.
If you wanted to learn yoga, music automatically came.
Yeah.
It was all part of the whole thing.
Yeah, so it was part of the traditional fabric of the whole life.
Yeah.
Which, and believe it or not, people, that's the way our lives really are, whether we are recognizing it or not. We
exactly.
really can't compartmentalize the way
that's
we think
true.
We can
cannot.
In the West. We are not life is not a supermarket in which we can only,
exactly.
you know,
but there's already,
choose what's on the shelf.
Yeah. Yeah, there's already a lot of spiritual supermarkets here.
Yeah, so that's
and few experiencers.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, and yeah, we can obviously go astray. And of course, the people think, well, you know, I want to know myself. Therefore, myself should be able to tell me what I need to know.
Yeah.
Well, that may not be true. You know, it may be that you're not really enough in tune with yourself to really figure out what some of this stuff is, and the question is in that your own intuitions are symptomatic of your disease, right?
Yeah.
rather than symptomatic of becoming healthy, some of the watchwords I'll use for that is like, well, you know, if I find that, you know, my spirituality is causing harm to other people, you know, causing incredible distress to my family or friends or whatever it is,
yep.
Yeah, probably not the right move. Yeah. I think, you know, that's probably a pretty good insight, saying, you know, maybe yep. I should rethink this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if I'm causing myself a lot of distress, or I'm causing other people distress, that's probably not the best form of spirituality. You know, that's not the way to meditate.
That's true.
You know, I remember beginner meditators, you know, saying, I don't like being around people because they distract me and they keep me from meditating, you know. And,
see, meditation should be similar to the pouring of oil from one container to the other.
Mm-hmm.
It still appears to be still, but it's still moving. That's meditation.
Yeah.
As opposed to the pouring of water from one jar to another.
Yeah, where you
see,
hear
the
that
movement,
wonderful
distractions and the wonderful
that
noise.
Things.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah. That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah. So, meditation also means to ponder on a particular subject, on a particular issue. So.
Remember now, so Sridhar is doing this concert. It's at the Barn at Valhalla. It's this Saturday night at 7 p.m. And I'd get there a little early, you know, so you can settle down and get a nice, comfortable place or whatever. And I'm definitely looking forward to it. And it's really been delightful. I don't know to what degree I've given you the third degree or not. I haven't been trying to, actually. But Sridhar, one of these days what we'll have to do is get you on here and we'll talk about various Indian teachers and their various things, because I know you've met Krishnamurti, the famous theosophical teacher.
Yeah, I used to live in the Theosophic Society, and Krishnamurti used to come there, and his room was two rooms away from mine. And we used to go for morning walks. When I was with my students, he would go for the walks.
Yeah, that must have been
It was wonderful. I used
delightful.
To play for him, yes. And he would tell me also, give me some input about music, mantras, and meditation.
Now, this is interesting because he was not traditionally trained, Krishnamurti particularly.
No. But he realized a lot about tradition.
Yeah.
And he respected it. So
he
kept it to himself.
Yeah.
So whenever he met me or some other traditional people, he will open up his traditional treasure box. But with others, he would shut.
He was, I heard him a few times. And he was a man of great wisdom whose books hardly even really betray it in certain ways. I mean, they really don't show what the kind of personality was. Well, we have to wrap up this hour. It's closing in.
Wow.
It went quick, and in fact, much too quickly. But you actually are a resident here for a good part of the year.
Yes, for a long time,
And so...
Yeah.
I am going to impose upon him again to come back around another time to
certainly
talk about whatever he wants to talk about.
Definitely. There's a lot to talk about. Yeah, we will do that.
And and remember, the whole point of talk is to ultimately allow the silence and allow the surrender to one's own basic awareness.
True.
And, you know, with all this music we're talking about here is really the greatest music is that profound silence that is our own awareness.
Because I always define music as a mental understanding of the soul in individual consciousness.
Yeah, there's that wonderful verse from the Upanishads, which loosely translated is, I hear two birds on the self-same tree.
Wow.
One bird suffers and suffers and knows all sorts of pleasures and mourns every loss of every feather, and the other bird just sits and witnesses
calmly
and feels nothing but sees all quietly. And so it is with our awareness.
So
one
bird is the seer, the other bird is the doer.
Yeah. Yeah, and one bird is the sticky, ours our sticky awareness, and the other bird is the Teflon awareness.
I think one bird thinks about himself, the other bird thinks about his self.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So one witnesses, so in the process of listening to music, we are both birds because they're the self-same, they were on the same tree. Thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you
Sridhar.
Very much for having me. It has been a great pleasure.
You have been listening to Touchstones. I'm the host here, Paul Nagy, and this is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro.